Why are so many dogs suffering from health issues? Actress Katherine Heigl, who's helped save over 16,000 dogs through her foundation, says she's seeing more issues with dogs' joints, odors, and health than ever before. And after doing a ton of research, she feels there's one place we can look to support any dog's health: their food. So she decided to create something she could actually feel good about feeding her dogs. It's called Superfood Complete. Superfood Complete is made with over 30 of the healthiest ingredients on the planet, including several superfoods vital to your dog's health. Badlands Ranch also sponsors the Jason Debus Heigl Foundation, which has helped rescue thousands of dogs and place them in loving homes. Dogs across America are trying this food and experiencing amazing health benefits. Go to badlandsranch.com/save50 and order right now to get up to 50% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. If you want your dog to experience all these incredible things, go to badlandsranch.com/save50 today.
This message comes from our sponsor, Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy: family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's TELADOC health/whatsyourwhy.
What's up, Open Floor Glow? This is Ben Golliver with the Washington Post. I am joined on the other line by Michael the Pod Pina, who has been covering the just completed playoffs for 538 and GQ. Michael, I think this episode is going to have to be called The Afterglow. I kid you not, I still smell of champagne. I cannot get the scent off my body. Last night was absolutely doused by LeBron James, a very excited LeBron James who helped lead the Lakers to the fourth title of his career, the 17th title in Lakers history, the first title of Anthony Davis's career, and LeBron along the way claimed his fourth Finals MVP award. It was a pretty stunning change of momentum again in this series, which started with the Lakers in total command. Miami made it so interesting with wins in games 3 and 5, but the Lakers punched back hard. They changed their starting lineup for game 6. They inserted Alex Caruso in place of Dwight Howard, and they were in total control from start to finish. Michael, how do you explain a series that was so tight in Miami's 2 wins, getting away from them entirely in game 6, and the Lakers really building a 30-plus point lead at various points and cruising to the championship ceiling win? What the heck happened last night?
I'm always so confused anytime a series, because this happens a lot, where like a team is up 3-2 and then the wheels just sort of fall off in a game 6 or a game 7. I was pretty confused, honestly, as it was happening. It was tough to process, honestly, especially for a team like Miami that is just so hard-nosed, so disciplined on the defensive end. They were just letting LeBron do whatever he wanted on drives to the basket. The easiest way to kind of sum it up, I have like a little checklist here, but like, number one, Miami just ran out of gas, right? Like, Jimmy Butler, there were those possessions in the second quarter where he's guarding Rajon Rondo so that he can switch onto either LeBron or AD and pick and rolls. And Rondo's just like blowing by Jimmy. And that could be exhaustion from a guy who basically was not able to rest in the previous game a couple nights prior, or a guy who knew that he wasn't going to get to rest really in that game either. So, you know, trying to pick his spots and rest on the court, but Rondo burned him. That's just like a microcosm of his own exhaustion. I think another one was just like Bam Adebayo, and this is kind of a bigger question, but like, or issue, but Bam Adebayo just did not look good, period. I mean, he was basically a net negative once he came back into this series, which was really disappointing because he was the best player in the Eastern Conference Finals. And then after that injury suffered when he ran into Dwight Howard in game 1, he couldn't lift his arms. He couldn't shoot. He couldn't grab loose balls. I mean, he was so ineffective around the basket, particularly in game five. Just wasn't able to finish. I mean, AD just completely overmatched him. You know, this was the first game that Goran Dragic came back after his game one injury. And, you know, understandably, he was ineffective on both ends. I mean, the Lakers targeted him a few times and had some success. And that's nothing against Goran. He only had one driving basket that was kind of like his signature heading into this series, where he was one of the most effective players on drives. And then, like, I mean, Anthony Davis just, in my opinion, solidified the fact that he is the best defensive player on the planet. And the way he intimidated particularly Tyler Hero on a couple of those early possessions, where Hero, it looked like he had layups, like wide open layups, saw AD out of the corner of his eye and tried to whip a pass out to the 3-point line. And it was either a turnover or just, you know, minus 2 points. Like, so that was, I thought, pretty, I thought that those factors really played into Miami's downfall. The Lakers just had more energy, more talent, and more confidence.
Yeah, I thought it was just an absolute clinic defensively by the Lakers, especially in the first half. Now, look, Miami was obviously exhausted. As you're mentioning, they're wounded. Bam is not right. Goran is valiantly trying to make this comeback in the, you know, season on the line type game, but he's definitely not right. And everyone had expended so much energy in that game five to make it happen, especially Jimmy, that you could just tell they didn't have another gear to go to. And the Lakers, I think, were really, you know, feeling, I don't know if embarrassed is the right word, but humbled a little bit after that game five win, where they all went in there with the gold sneakers and the Kobe jerseys and expecting to, like, kind of write their own story. Yep. And they tempted fate, right? And they refocused very, very well. I loved the starting lineup adjustment from Frank Vogel, because Dwight had kind of struggled in this series. There's always a moment where you're going to downshift at some point, it seems like, in these playoffs. You have to deploy it at the right time. To pick Caruso rather than Morris, who had kind of started in place of Dwight in second halves at various points, was such a smart move, because it just made cleaner matchups. It allowed them to be more active, faster, more versatile, more switchy defensively. And I call it a clinic because they were working hard on the defensive end. The hardest thing to do in the NBA is to be an active, committed defender for long stretches of time. That's why you always see guys get frustrated with each other when someone lets down, because all of that work, everybody else's work, is going to waste. You know, they use that phrase, you know, playing defense on a string. And when five guys are playing hard defensively like the Lakers do, it doesn't look like effort anymore. It looks effortless. You know, it's almost like they're floating and levitating around the court. And I just think, for all the basketball coaches and high school players out there that are listening to this, go back and use that first half of Game 6 as your teaching tape. That is a championship team that wants to seal that thing. They want to, you know, stomp on their opponent's neck. And they did it with their defense. I mean, they were making everything difficult for Miami. Now, Miami didn't have the most ball handlers and creators to kind of come back at them, but they just did a great job of, you know, it didn't even look like extra effort plays, even though they were making extra effort plays all over the court, because they were on that string and it just looked, you know, easy breezy. You love to see it. They turned so much defense into offense. LeBron was trying to get out of transition constantly. That was a major factor as they built their lead. The standout moment from the whole game, to me, was when Anthony Davis got the dunk to put them up 20. He gets the and one, yeah. And at that moment, it starts to feel like, okay, this is not going to go the other direction. And look, the Lakers, it was a really tense environment for Game 5, right? And the weight of the pressure, this idea, like, are they really going to blow a 3-1 in the bubble? Like, that was starting to percolate before Game 6 for sure. And they did a great job coming out focused and not letting that stuff kind of get into their heads. Anthony Davis dunks to go up 20. He gets fouled. And LeBron, there's no celebration. LeBron's standing right behind him, and he's just circling his index fingers, basically telling everybody on the court, particularly KCP in that moment, you know, basically just saying, let's go faster. Let's do this more. Let's not let up. Let's keep this thing going. I think they went on a 10-0 run after that free throw that Anthony Davis took, and that put the game away for good. The rest was academic. So it's just an example of, like, when you do realize you're in an advantageous situation, you know, take it all the way through. That's how you finish a title off. I was impressed. I'll be honest. Like, I never really loved or felt this strong emotional connection to this Lakers group, in part because it was so many new faces and the mercenary aspect that we're talking about. And I think that they usually get viewed as this star-studded, big market, stole Anthony Davis from New Orleans. You know, there's a lot of, like, easy tropes to use to kind of criticize them. But they won that with sound, fundamental team basketball in Game 6, and I don't want that to get overlooked in all of the adulation of LeBron or all the hype of Anthony Davis. I mean, their defense was absolutely rock solid in that first half.
Defense was great. All the tropes that you mentioned are also true. I know that that'll get me in trouble with all the Lakers faithful, and I apologize, but you kind of mentioned the emotional connection that you had to this team, or one that maybe you didn't expect.
I said I never really felt it. There's certain teams that I'll go back and I'll always feel like super fondly towards in terms of like their play style, their main characters. I mean, for sure, the 2014 Spurs always jump out. The 2015 Warriors were a special group. I mean, there's been a couple other, you know, a lot of people really like the 11 Mavericks. They weren't my favorite, but I definitely have a healthy respect for them. You know, I look at this group, I'm going to look back and just remember the day-to-day devotion of LeBron, how hard he worked, all the burden he carried on and off the court in the bubble, and the fact that they were able to kind of finish it off, you know, kind of storybook fashion. I'm going to remember that for sure. I'm definitely going to remember the post-game celebration, and we can dig into that in a minute. But in terms of, like, this particular group, I'm not sure it's, like, this iconic roster with this very clear identity. You know, it was more like, hey, we have a good idea. Let's go team up in L.A. This could be fun.
exactly. And real quick, because I know we're going to dig into all this in a bit, but, like, the post-game celebration, real quick, like, watching Anthony Davis cry, it just like didn't, you know, you want that moment to really mean something as someone connecting to basketball and loving basketball. And like, I'm 100% not, this isn't me criticizing him for crying or anything like that. I'm just saying that there was no like emotional, I guess connection for personally watching.
You weren't crying, is what you're saying. You're not getting any misty or anything when you're watching.
I was crying for different reasons, and that started in about the second quarter. But watching AD, like I just didn't feel like you mentioned some of those other teams where you know if you see even like you know I obviously come in here with a little bit of a bias, but watching a Kevin Garnett scream to the rafters after he wins his first title, there's more of a, I feel like there's more of a universal connection to that type of moment, you know, where this player has been through so much more and we've been through so much more with this player as a community of basketball lovers. So to see it be with the Lakers, to see them kind of, you know, AD is this guy who basically was under contract and then was like, I don't want to be here anymore. And he punted a season in his prime and all of that. I just can't really forget all of those things. So when I see him cry, I'm just like, not really okay. Like, cool, you won a title. Let's move on to the next season, I guess was my takeaway, which I apologize to whoever I'm offending with that take.
You're hilarious. Don't apologize. Keep it real, Michael. Here's the contrast I would draw. Tell me if you agree with this.
Okay.
I think in a lot of years, if a player has a relatable journey or a struggle or the mountain climb effect of, hey, we've got to go bit by bit to finally get over the hump. Kyle Lowry is a perfect example. Not very many people like Kyle Lowry before he won the title. He was an easy punching bag, terrible field goal percentage in the playoffs, you know, underrated by the masses and all that, right? I mean, memes making fun of him, all that kind of stuff. He wins the title, and now there's this huge, like, influx of support for Kyle Lowry. Oh, man, what a journey. He went through so much, so many playoff struggles, and he finally got it done. And people are kind of, like, happy for him. There's a relatability factor to that because I think a lot of fan bases around the league could say, wow, like, I have a favorite veteran who's never been able to do it. Imagine if he got to experience what Kyle Lowry did. What an incredible satisfaction. The problem with the Lakers is that they are not relatable to any other fan base in the NBA because there is no other team that can have the best player in basketball decide that he wants to use their brand to expand his off-court media and movie empire and then have his close friend and agent orchestrate a trade request to pull in, you know, like a top five, six talent who's been languishing and who's still under contract from a small market franchise and just drop him in and then basically go, you know, bargain basement garage sale shopping with veterans who are ready to kind of hop along board. Like, there's just no other franchise that could replicate this Lakers path to a title. And so that's an obvious source of resentment. And there's a lot of franchises who had strong cases like, hey, Anthony Davis, if you come here, you could win a title. And you could say if you go back 2 years, they had a lot stronger cases to Anthony Davis, you know, better setups, younger cores, more balanced situations and whatever else. And yet they never even got a look. I mean, remember when he was on stage at the 2019 All-Star Weekend and people are like, well, what's your list, Anthony? And he like came up with like this fake list. And then everyone realized, and they're like, no, really just the Lakers is the list. And he's going to wind up on the Lakers and it's just a matter of time, right? And I think that that's sort of what you're getting at here, where, you know, Anthony Davis is going to be happy. Anthony Davis's family is going to feel very happy. You know, sure. LeBron's whole quote about Frank Sinatra, I did it my way. That's true. But your way isn't everyone else's way. And that's going to leave this as, I think, kind of a polarizing title run.
Yeah, I 100% agree with all of that. And you throw in all of the bubble and the weirdness of the bubble and the teams that we thought that the Lakers would have had to have faced to get to the mountaintop, and they didn't have to face those teams, and they didn't have to face the reigning finals MVP or the two-time back-to-back MVP or a Houston Rockets team that wasn't ravaged by COVID. So there are some these weird extenuating circumstances that should be factored into this conversation to make it a little bit more nuanced. But like, also at the end of the day, they won the title and you can never take that away from them. And it's hard to say, hey, Anthony, you made the wrong decision. Like, no one's going to say that. Obviously he made the right one. They won the championship. He is the future face of the most popular franchise in the sport and one of the most popular franchises in sports franchises in the entire world. So obviously it's working out for Anthony Davis, and like, my doubt of his ability to rise to this level, he obviously squashed that. He was incredible. I still would have probably voted him for finals MVP, and I'm kind of shocked that he didn't get a single vote out of the nine media members who do vote. That was kind of weird to me. But I agree with everything else that you're saying about how just the circumstances of how this team was constructed make it very hard to relate to and connect with.
Yeah, on the finals MVP voting, it did not surprise me. It's the bubble group think, man. Like, this has been LeBron's bubble for a while. And like, the closer in proximity you are to him, the harder it is to kind of, you know, balance things rationally. Mm-hmm. I think also Anthony's, you know, rough game three probably cost him a little bit. And then, you know, LeBron was just a consistent force throughout this series orchestrating. And I think he finished strong. And I think people really looked at that game five performance too. I mean, that was just an absolutely ridiculous game and a losing effort that probably kind of sealed it for him. So let's stick with LeBron. When you're ranking his four titles and when you're taking into account all of the factors that we're describing, whether he's going to be embraced, whether he's the good guy, whether he's the bad guy, I mean, he's up on stage asking for his bleep respect, his dang respect. It's very, very interesting that that was one of his messages. You know, clearly he's feeling, I think, criticism from all directions, particularly, you know, political criticism. I think, you know, that stuff is most likely getting to him at this point because he's been so out front on so many polarizing topics, and that must have been such a satisfying win given those circumstances in particular. But you look back at his title runs. 2012, they beat the Young Thunder, his first title. 2013, Ray Allen saves the day with the corner three, and then they finish it off in Game 7 against a very good San Antonio Spurs team. 2016, he leads the 3-1 comeback against the 73-win Warriors. to end Cleveland's drought. And then 2020 now, he takes the Lakers through the bubble on a 16-5 run and puts away the Miami Heat. You know, a very strong and plucky performance from Jimmy Butler, but, you know, still there was some injury issues on Miami's side. If you were to rank those four titles in terms of, like, most important, greatest achievements, legacy defining, where would this one fall?
I think it's hard to answer that question without extracting or disentangling the bubble from the equation, so I'm just going to try to keep it to basketball
as much as possible. Nope. You're not going to do that. You're going to go the other way. You're going to keep it entangled, okay? This is the bubble title. There's no way we can ever look at it differently. We're always going to look at it this way, right? So all the bubble stuff has to count. And by the way, like, you know, for 2012, you get to count it because it was his first one, right? That's something getting over the hump, all those years of struggling in Cleveland, that counts. I guess the way I'm defining this is it's less about the rational basketball action and more about the emotional feel and how people will remember it. And you know, when you're looking back on his career, say 15, 20 years from now, although he could still be playing, let's leave that possibility open.
It's true.
Which are the ones that are going to jump to you first? And I asked this question because in 2016, everyone said this was the moment. This was the single greatest title, period. Personally, I still feel that way. That would be my number one. But where would you rank the bubble title?
I think even after your little preamble here, my rankings are the same. I think that this is the least impressive of all of four.
Wow, Michael, you are really deep into the hater raid today, I swear.
No, I mean, the other ones are, like, great. Like, it speaks to the runs that he had. I do think that the greatest and most important game of his career came in that 2012 run, Game 6 in TD Garden. I don't know if that Oklahoma City Thunder team in the finals was better or worse than this Miami Heat team, but that Thunder team was very good. You know, the Spurs, the Hall of Famers that were there, Greg Popovich, the pedigree, having to face Kawhi Leonard, who was just coming on as one of the better perimeter defenders in basketball and a true legitimate rival, I think, in a lot of ways for LeBron. And I mean, like, Ray Allen shot also, like, that's incredible. I think that the 2016 title will forever be his apex and the number one thing that he's recognized for. And I mean, LeBron himself said that he considered himself the greatest player ever after that title. And while I don't necessarily, that's a completely different conversation about him being the best player ever. It clearly means a lot for him to have ended the drought in Cleveland, to go back there to prove a lot of people wrong, including people with the Miami Heat organization who thought that it was going to be the biggest mistake of his career. So there's a little bit of a difference between going back to the Cavs, a small market team, very difficult to attract free agents, versus going to the Lakers and winning a championship with all of their history and everything that goes into their greatness.
Yeah. So here's a way to put it. I mean, look, my whole family is from Michigan. I mean, there's an entire industry of clothing between the states of Michigan and Ohio that basically just is expletive in the name of the state, right? Bleep Ohio, bleep Michigan. Even I could rally around this idea. And I personally, Cleveland is one of my least favorite stops in the NBA because their version of vegetarian food is mozzarella sticks, right?
Yes.
So I have a tough time there. But even I could rally around the 2016 title and be like, yes, that's what it's supposed to be about.
It was great.
Right. A lot of the elements that we were describing earlier, like that maybe are missing from this Lakers title, were actually there in that 2016 title. So I would agree that that's number one. I actually think that this bubble title it's really close with this one or 2013. I'm going to pick the 2013 one for LeBron because of my respect for the quality of competition. Bottom line, they stole that title and did not deserve it. That should have been Tim Duncan's ring. Kawhi Leonard blew it for him. I will never forgive him for that. So did Greg Popovich. Duncan should have gotten a title. Popovich and Leonard should not have gotten a title for the missed free throws and for the decision to sub Duncan out on the critical rebounding possession. So I'll go two there. I will put the bubble three, and it's very close. And actually, as time passes, I could see myself talking myself into moving it up to two. It's just inseparable from the entire experience. The quality of competition, I think, is the weakest aspect of this title. And yet he still went through Damian Lillard, James Harden, Jimmy Butler playing at his peak levels, Nikola Jokic, Jamal Murray playing out of his mind. There were talented players along the way. Now, again, it's the first time that we've really seen LeBron have the better team basically in every series, right? And that's something that we saw a lot in the Eastern Conference when he was getting through to the finals, but he was almost always an underdog, or at least it was very tight in a number of these finals. So I think from that standpoint, people are going to be docking him because he had the more talented team. That's part of the deal. You know, it's like we don't take points off for Jordan having the more talented team in all of his title runs. So I would, and also I think proximity here matters. You know, I mean, Chris Paul made a comment to me basically saying, like, unless you're in the bubble, you can't get it. And I hate to sound like a bubble elitist, but I really do think that this was just a completely unique, different, incredibly difficult, challenging experience. By far the best reporting assignment of my life. Everything going forward from here is going to pale in comparison. I would actually say last night's title celebration, even though I haven't necessarily had the strongest fondness for this Lakers group, was the single most fun night of my entire writing career, reporting career, because of the release factor after everybody being pent up for 3 months and the excitement that everyone gets to go home. We finally reached the finish line. It felt like college graduation. I mean, that was really the feeling. And so even though we're in an empty gym with guys running around with expensive champagne, it's just that was that was the feeling. And you can tell I'm being truthful here because I just railed about superlatives on the last episode, Michael, so I wouldn't double back with false superlatives if I didn't mean it. So I think from that standpoint, it will be very memorable. I think from a coverage standpoint, it will be that one or 2016 will be the most memorable, I think, from this decade for me. And then I would put the Oklahoma City one last because I tend to backload it and look a little bit more at the finals matchup as compared to the early round play. But right. I understand why you would put game six there up on the pedestal. So let's talk about this post game scene, Michael. You're laughing at me as I'm describing how much fun it was. You're in full hater mode, so give me your perspective. Give me the counter argument. Did it look lame? Have you been to cooler parties with your friends down the block in Brooklyn? I mean, how much do you want to dig in here?
Hey, I mean first of all, Ben, you gotta, as the journalist, you gotta disentangle yourself, remove yourself from the story, which you're not doing when you're trying to judge whether or not this was LeBron's most difficult or important or whatever word you want to use, championship. So obviously you're looking at it through a biased lens, and that's okay. But I just want the record to kind of stand there before we move on to discuss this this celebration.
I don't know. Is that true? Am I really doing that? I think I've been pretty balanced on that.
You're okay. I think that the
proximity here part is important because you don't. I mean, look, I can't tell you what LeBron went through here in the bubble because I didn't have to play 42 minutes against Jimmy Butler, who's right. playing the best basketball of his entire life, right? But I can tell you that as someone who has devoted myself to my craft as hard as I ever have for the last 3 months, this was absolutely the most difficult challenge I've ever gone through. I mean, there's games where I'm coming home dizzy and lightheaded because I've watched 9 straight hours of basketball. I'm just sitting there writing and reporting. I put this in one of the stories I wrote, but you know, my iPhone screen time peaked at more than 11 hours per day during the early playoffs because there was just so much basketball to take place, right? Up until every single night, 3, 4 a.m. for 3 months straight, doing everything I possibly can to maintain a mental balance from daily exercise to food intake to sleep management and all of that.
No, like, and like
I just think it's really easy for people who aren't here to be like, oh yeah, that bubble was no. was nothing. And like, bottom line is people who weren't going through it are just flat wrong. They don't get it. And there's no way to say that without coming off pompous, but I think that needs to be said.
No, I don't want it to sound like I am belittling or diminishing the struggle of being inside an environment like that, because I know for me personally, I would have a very difficult time being away from my family, being away from my wife for that long. So I can, like, yeah, 100%, huge sacrifice by you and everyone else who was in attendance. Before we move on, it's just like, I can't really get past, and this is not LeBron's fault at all. It's not the Lakers' fault at all, because all you can do is play the team that is in front of you. But I just am so disappointed as a basketball fan that we did not get to see some of the matchups that I thought, going back to literally a year ago, Ben. Like, think about where we were a year ago when we were anticipating the 2019-20 NBA season. Seeing some of those matchups in the playoffs just never happen is tough for me to swallow. And I'm not even saying this as someone who likes the Celtics. I'm not saying this as someone who isn't particularly fond of the Lakers when they're successful. I'm saying this as just someone who loves X's and O's, basketball, narratives, all of that. So that is, for me, a little sad.
No, I hear you. Well, look, nobody wanted Lakers-Clippers more than I did. I don't think anybody wanted Lakers-Bucks more than I did. But I actually think that burnishes the Lakers' title here rather than detracts from it. And the reason why I say it is that just shows you how difficult the bubble was. You had some really talented, really, really good basketball teams get here and not be able to take it. The Rockets crumbled. Clippers crumbled. Bucks crumbled. They just could not deal with it. And when you look at the teams that did have success, including your Boston Celtics, including the Toronto Raptors, including the Miami Heat, including the Denver Nuggets, it was all the toughest minded teams that were just like, all right, we're fully dedicated to basketball. We don't care about distractions. Let's just go out there and hoop. And the fact that the Lakers, and specifically LeBron, who's 10 to 12, 15 years older than these guys that he's beating, wound up being the last guy standing, that's pretty impressive to me, right? Now, is it better than beating a 73-win Warriors team? No. Is it better than beating Tim Duncan and stealing a trophy out of his clutch? Well, no. But it's still pretty darn good. And I think that we can only blame the teams that couldn't handle the pressure of the bubble for their shortcomings. And the fact that the Lakers beat the teams that beat those other teams, that's to their credit, in my opinion.
Sure. So, the celebration. Can I ask you a couple real quick questions? Just like, please. From your, just like, I guess like a TikTok would be great, because like the final buzzer sounds and everyone's at center court and, you know, Jeannie Buss speaks and Frank Vogel speaks and LeBron speaks. Like, where are you when all of that is going on? Are you along the sideline? Are you at your seat still? Just like, are you? I know you. I know that you're trying to be in the hallway, trying to get those pics for the gram. Yeah, like, where are you kind of standing?
Trying to be thirsty. Yeah, you know me. You're like, you. I know you. Thirsty Ben. No, so it actually worked out great because it was a blowout. So I'm on deadline in that situation. So I just sent my story in during the third quarter. Second time I've done that during this series, by the way. Pretty incredible. And then I started snooping around the arena to try to find the Larry O'Brien trophy, because it's in that awesome Louis Vuitton box, and I just wanted to take like 20 pictures of that. Never successfully found it. As the buzzer was counting down, basically they would not let independent media, if you don't work for ESPN, you can't get on the court for the celebration. So I essentially had to go to the sideline, and I actually took that moment to congratulate Michelle Roberts. I think I congratulated one of the union lawyers, maybe Mark Tatum, because they're all just standing there. There's not very many people there. And I basically just said, hey, like, congratulations, you guys made it through. This is great. Good job. And then I tried to get as much video as I could just of the on-court celebration. And then at that point, you're just tweeting stuff as fast as you possibly can. The on-court celebration, where they actually do like the trophy presentation, that takes a lot longer in real life maybe than it feels like on television. Like, it feels like that thing just drags and drags. Everyone gets to talk. Yep. So as soon as it ended, I basically sprinted back in towards the hallway by the Lakers locker room, because we have seen other teams celebrate after series victories and been able to get like pretty interesting content from that spot. And in fact, when the Nuggets won their dramatic Game 7, they actually like let us in the back hallway. So we had all these amazing opportunities to see Jamal Murray celebrate. And the NBA set up new rules, like basically making a wall so we couldn't get all the way into that hallway right by the locker room. So it was this cat and mouse game, basically. It's like, how close can we get without violating these NBA protocols to capture the celebrations? And basically what happened was the Lakers were so excited and their locker room was so small because it's not like a real NBA locker room. It's kind of like a converted, not storage closet, but like maintenance room or something like that. They came just busting out with the champagne and just, you know, found the nearest reporters and just like sprayed the living crap out of us with champagne. So if people haven't seen that video, if you want to see what it looks like to get doused by LeBron with champagne, it is on my Twitter page at Ben Golliver. It was pretty funny. Just side note, like I haven't had a drink since 2006. Wow. So yeah, so the champagne that hit my mask, that like was the first time I really smelled alcohol like that in years and years and years, and you could taste it just slightly through the mask. So I was joking, that's like the drunkest I've been in 15 years, even though obviously I wasn't actually drunk, I didn't drink any, but it was just, again, a unique experience. Like I said, I mean, my whole suit was soaked. I was there with the guy, Omar, who started up House of Highlights. He works at ESPN now. We both just got absolutely wrecked by Danny Green and LeBron. And then from there, my whole mentality is like, well, mostly people care about one person, right? So just kind of tag along with LeBron. He's being followed by the Last Dance crew. You know, I think I had mentioned to you that Andy Thompson, the same guy who did the Last Dance, Michael Jordan, has been following LeBron around since the second round. Getting footage for a future documentary project. So he was right up in my face with the camera after I got doused. So there is a chance, Michael, in this future project, I will have a cameo as the guy who absolutely got nailed by the champagne, which would be which would be pretty ridiculous. And then from there, LeBron got on FaceTime with his children, then got on FaceTime with his mom, and he took a cigar out to this little hallway and was just laying on his back talking to them, having a great time. And Markieff Morris actually came over and doused him completely with champagne, ruining his cigar. And at that point,
that's a party
LeBron,
foul.
Yeah, LeBron looked pissed, but he also was like trying to keep it in. So he did a pretty good job. I'm sure he just found another cigar. It's not like it's irreplaceable. And from there, he just goes and does a million interviews, you know. And so they had the trophies out, which is always fun to take pictures of. He was in a phenomenal mood, as you could imagine. Markieff Morris walking around and telling a whole group of reporters, you guys want to know what a champ looks like? Just look at bleeping me. I'm a champ. You know, it's just some of these moments that you're just kind of really not going to forget. Anthony Davis and the whole hubbub, he disappeared somewhere. I think he was probably doing interviews on the court maybe, so I didn't get to see too much of his celebration, but it was raucous. And if you and I go back all the way to like June and July, I think we were predicting that was going to be like the worst part, right? Because mm-hmm. it's an empty arena. It's just going to be flat. It's not going to be cool. I actually think, again, the bubble's intimacy, where like we are spending all this time with these guys day after day after day. It's the same faces. You can't escape it. Everybody knows everybody. It really did kind of like it was a better championship celebration than basically any of the other ones I've been to. I mean, I was at the Warriors one. I've got corks from the Warriors locker room when KD won. I was in the hallway when KD and Jerry West told KD he was going to leave the Warriors. You know, I was like 5 feet away when that happened. So there's been some special, like, you know, post-title moments. But I would put this one at the top just because of the excitement to leave. You know, as Danny Green said, we're bleeping free. And he's running around with the champagne bottles. And I think that's how everybody felt, including, by the way, the NBA officials. You know, I think everybody was ready to pack up and move home. And just as a footnote, you know, my flight is until this evening, so I'm not going to leave the bubble until about 2:30 p.m. So I went out for a walk this morning. I did not see a single other person. I went for a 5-mile walk, did not see anyone. It is a complete ghost town. Everybody got out of here as quickly as possible.
Understandable. My two follow-up questions, one of them was, did you have any champagne, which you've already answered.
I did not, but you know, I'm bringing some home with me. I mean, my suit stinks, Michael. And it's like, one of my, I only brought three suits, so I bought my three best suits, and I had to kind of like rotate them during the finals because, you know, there's, what are you going to do, bring six suits to Orlando in the middle of July? And I wasn't even totally sure we were going to make it, and there's obviously nowhere for me to buy a new suit, so we're just rotating the same clothes, you know? That suit is going to have, it's going to need like a full car wash detailing, not just dry cleaning.
Yeah, and then my next stinks. My next question is, you know, I didn't really even, I've kind of forgot about the bubble protocols about not being allowed in locker rooms. It just kind of slipped my mind, honestly. And then after seeing all the footage of the players celebrating on Instagram Live, etc. Yeah, so my next question is just kind of like, you know, for me, I have not covered as many finals as you, but I've been to two or three. And what I've made a habit of doing is after the final game, going into the losers' locker room, because first of all, it's just easier to kind of walk around, and
you're going to get an exclusive.
Exactly. You'd see the scene, but it's also just like, I don't know, I find it more interesting sometimes to see how people and human beings respond to this is rock bottom for them professionally in a lot of ways. And so I'm personally more intrigued by that just professionally as a journalist. So did you have any, like, even if you wanted to, would there have been an opportunity to kind of like see what the Miami Heat were going through last night?
It's a fascinating question. I love where your mind is going. So here's what they did. There was so much interest, obviously, in the various Lakers players that they actually took both press conference rooms that they usually typically have, one for Heat and one for Lakers, and kind of out of respect, I think, to both sides, not wanting to have a huge press conference for the Heat where nobody was there, mm-hmm. And also wanting to be able to more quickly accommodate all of the Lakers players so that they could get the chance, because they often like to have first-time guys who are winning their championship for the first time have the ability to do a press conference just so that they've got their emotions on tape, right? And so there was a lot of guys in that situation. I mean, KCP, Dwight, I mean, you go right down the list, all those guys got podium interviews. So they actually basically stashed the Heat on like side venue that had been used typically like just for some of the Zoom calls for like role players. So even like Eric Spoelstra, Jimmy Butler were sort of in this almost auxiliary room, and the main press conference setup that they had made specifically for the finals, which had two rooms, were actually both given to the Lakers. So it was the first time that they had done this in the entire bubble. Mm-hmm. So from that standpoint, it basically made me choose, do I stick with LeBron and the Lakers, or do I go see what the Heat were up to? At that point, I didn't feel like I could kind of leave the LeBron scene because there was just so much interest on social media. I mean, things were going absolutely crazy. All the Lakers fans were out of the woodwork for sure. So I did not get a chance to personally see any of the Heat, but I imagine that it was as gut-wrenching as possible. I believe Rachel Nichols had a video of Bam walking around late night and just sort of being able to see and hear and watch the Lakers celebration at the only restaurant here in the bubble. And obviously, as I was writing my closing work last night at about 3 a.m., I could still hear them celebrating. I mean, it's not very far away. It's, you know, 300 yards away probably. So again, just a very interesting and weird dynamic here. But I think if you had wanted to go to the Heat side, you could have had 20 minutes with Spo. You know, you would
have been sick. No, that's exactly where my head's at. And I mean, I don't know if you saw, but I'm sure you did, Eric Spoelstra's post-game presser. You know, he's wiping tears from his eyes for like 30 seconds before answering the first question. And I mean, that stuff is just like, that's why we love sports, because like there's the celebratory nature, but then there's also defeat and agony, right, and everything that goes with that. And there's really no value in the celebration if there is no pain in loss. So,
well, I love it. No, I agree 1000%. And not to beat this this horse dead, but I think that also, again, that underscores why the bubble can't be disentangled from this particular title, and why, mm-hmm, we should give the Lakers credit for it. Because losing after 3 months of isolation is a different kind of despair. That is a different kind of heartbreak, right? And my mind was actually after game five thinking like, imagine if they blew the 3-1 lead, right? If you're the Lakers, you blow the 3-1 lead, LeBron's legacy is like tarnished forever. This is like the worst, most humiliating defeat of his career. He just put 3 months in away from his family and everything else, and this would have been an utter catastrophe. And, you know, there would have been no explaining it. So, again, that's part of the reason why I was so impressed by their Game 6 performance, because they did that with all of the expectations and pressure. And, you know, Miami was playing with house money the whole way through, and it showed in both their wins, actually. But, you know, still just a gutting loss for them. And also for Jimmy Butler, too. I mean, I pointed this out when we did the Jimmy Butler episode, but he's had his heart broken by LeBron a lot. And as bad as that game winner in 2015 when LeBron hits the jumper in his face in Chicago to silence the crowd, that one hurt. I promise you, playing your absolute best in games 3 and 5 and then losing in 6 in blowout fashion because you just couldn't muster the energy, I promise you that one hurt more, especially after 3 months in the bubble. And so, again, that's why I do think the bubble deserves a lot of credit.
Yeah, and I mean, yeah, I agree with you that the bubble deserves credit, and it's just such an extenuating circumstance. You know, before the games even started, I was thinking a lot about how, and I never wrote it about this, but I thought about it, about how we would kind of contextualize like the loss of competition in a competition format versus everything that's going on in the world, and how we would maybe not care as much as an audience. And to a certain degree, when we look at Miami, that's kind of how I feel. Like, they have nothing to hang their heads about, and they exceeded expectations and all of that. But if you are a member of the Miami Heat, you must feel like, I just sacrificed so much, and what was it for? You know what I mean? Like, that's terrible.
No, that's what I'm saying. It was absolutely heartbreaking. Michael, this is getting dark, so I want to leave you with a moment of levity from the celebration. Can I go back one moment the other way before we get into a couple more questions here to close out? So LeBron's on the floor. He is FaceTiming with his mother, Gloria, and he starts the call by saying, "Mama, Mama." I don't know if you saw that video. It went like crazy viral. None other than the singer Vanessa Williams hit me up on Instagram to say, "Will you please post this video to Instagram? I saw it on your Twitter. I need to reshare it to all my Instagram followers."
Wow.
So I did it. And now I think basically I am best friends with Vanessa Williams. So, you know, 2 degrees of separation, Michael. You're pretty close to Vanessa yourself now.
Tell her what up. Congratulations to you. That's incredible.
Look, I'm just going to air it all out. She actually sent me a voice memo on Instagram and said, "Oh, you've got a podcast. I might listen to it." So it was a real big day over here.
Okay, now I know that you're going too far, and that's okay. That's okay. That obviously never happened.
My right hand is on the first Sports Illustrated cover that Michael Jordan ever got. I promise you, this happened. I couldn't make it up, Michael. Now, was she enjoying a Lakers victory? It's possible. What she told me, though, and I actually thought it was pretty poignant, she's like, "Look, as a mom of black kids, that moment hit hard, you know?" And I think that the bubble also had a way of humanizing players. And I put this in my essay about leaving the bubble. In normal life, there are sunglasses, there are tinted windows, there are gated communities, there are security details. There are just a million ways that people who have lots and lots of money can separate themselves emotionally, physically from normies like us. It's just very easy to not have to deal with, whether it's reporters, the average Joe, whatever it might be. There's an awful lot of ways to hide. And sometimes it can just be your wealth. You can dress in a certain way. You know, you can have a certain type of car. You can live in a certain neighborhood. There is just a massive distance from a class perspective that is available to these athletes, especially someone on LeBron's level. And those walls mostly came down in the bubble. Now, obviously, I'm not walking around the hall doing, you know, ding dong ditch on the Lakers' doors at 3 a.m. in their hotel room because the hotels are off limits to us. But a
missed
lot
opportunity.
Of,
I just want to say, but continue.
Well, that would have got me, you know, kicked out for sure. But I keep going back to this idea of proximity. There is just a different relationship in this experience that will never be the same again in the NBA, right? I mean, we're probably going to go back to a situation where it's going to be hard for reporters to get back into locker rooms. It's going to be a lot of stilted press conferences going forward and all that kind of stuff. And here the players were just humanized. They mostly wore sweats because they had to go back to their hotel to shower. They didn't even really care about putting on airs or being that cool because ultimately they were stuck in the same hotels that we were stuck in, right? They couldn't go home, you know, just like we couldn't go home. So it's not like everyone was sitting around in a, you know, yoga circle and singing Kumbaya together, but there was, you know, a little bit of this kind of shared experience. And so again, that humanizing moment, even though LeBron's got 15 cameras on him, where he's just kind of having that connection with his mom, I do think that that one resonated with a lot of people in a way that maybe some of his more forced press conference statements don't quite resonate.
In 50 years, there's going to be like 6,000 media members who will claim that they were in the bubble. So I feel like if I were you, that would be such a badge of honor to have actually participated, because everyone's going to want to say that they were actually there.
It's going to be like the Wilt Chamberlain 100-point game.
Exactly, exactly.
All right, let's wrap up here with a couple more questions. So you did bring up this issue of the Heat, and I don't want to just only talk about the Lakers here because they had a sensational run through the bubble. I mean, they knock off three higher-seeded teams. They dismantle the Bucks. They beat, or really outlasted, we probably should say, the Boston Celtics, and they put up quite a fight when they easily could have rolled over here in the finals. I think Jimmy Butler's takeaway quote was that the Heat will be back, and I am not totally sure they will to the same level. Now, obviously, they have some younger players, heroes coming along. Duncan Robinson showed that he can kind of settle in as that series unfolded, especially Game 5. You know, he was phenomenal. 7 3-pointers. Bam is only going to get better. I just wonder, was this the best series of Jimmy's career? Did so many things break right? Did the bubble suit them perfectly? What about Goran in terms of his future? You know, unless they get like a big-time free agent acquisition here in the next couple of summers, is it possible that they're going to be falling back into like the Eastern Conference second tier, and there's just so many other talented teams on the rise that could maybe take their spot? I guess, what do you think, bottom line, Miami's staying power? Are they going to be back in the finals again next year? If you had to bet over the next 3 years, over under, how many finals do you think they make?
Man, this is a tough question to answer because I don't want to be disrespectful to so many of the people in that organization who I adore. Like, I think Eric Spoelstra is the best coach in the world. Jimmy's always been one of my favorite players. You mentioned Bam. I think Bam is just going to be a perennial defensive player of the year candidate. His offensive game is continuously blossoming, and it's just such a shame that he was physically unable to perform to the level that we thought he could in the finals because of his shoulder slash neck injury or whatever was going on there. But he'll be better. He'll be an all-star basically for the next 10 years. Tyler Hero will make a leap, one would assume. Duncan Robinson is just, he's like one of the best shooters alive, maybe the best shooter alive on the move, off the catch. At the same time, like, I think that the bubble was such an interesting, unusual, unprecedented circumstance that it was almost destined to allow a team like Miami to get as far as it did. And so I kind of put Miami in the same category as I do a team like the Denver Nuggets, where they overachieved as well. And I don't know if we should be penciling the Denver Nuggets in to get to the Western Conference Finals next season. I look at Toronto, I look at Boston, I look at, obviously, Milwaukee, assuming that Giannis...
Let me stop you right there. Just to ask a question. So I think the odds makers have said the Lakers are the favorites to win the title next year. They're the early favorite. Yeah. And I think that a lot of people would say, well, they're the favorite to win the West even more so than being the favorite to win it all, right? Where would you have Miami on your early pecking order? And I know it's tough because we haven't seen free agency and everything else, but just kind of like coming out of this ballpark, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, with the teams that we know that they're going to be there. I mean, I think I'd probably have them above a Toronto. just because of some of the age issues. Gasol's leaving.
Yeah, it's so hard because of free agency, right? Like, Fred VanVleet is a humongous player for the Toronto Raptors. He's a free agent. He could be on the New York Knicks next season. We have the Brooklyn Nets being in a playoff series with Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving, if healthy. Like, they could be just a total monster.
So wait, what's darker? You wanting to go to the Miami Heat locker room by yourself or Fred VanVleet on the New York Knicks? You're in a real tough mind space. I swear, man, Massachusetts is not taking this title very well at all.
No, we're not. I think it's a really difficult one to answer. So I don't know if I would put Miami behind Toronto. I might put them in front based on the performances that we saw from some of their younger pieces. But you also did mention Dragic. And Dragic is, I think, 34 and coming off a pretty serious foot injury.
Yeah, man, that felt like his shot, didn't it? That's part of my thing, too. So I guess I'm looking at it. I think I have Miami third.
Okay, do you have Milwaukee and Boston ahead?
Correct. And then Miami, then I think then Toronto, and then Philly. I mean,
well, the thing is, we laugh about Philly, but like...
I guess, I'm forgetting Brooklyn. Maybe they are fourth. Yeah. Maybe Brooklyn's third.
Yeah, no, I think, but like, you know, I've made plenty of jokes about the Philadelphia 76ers on here. I think Philly is, like, super interesting from the perspective that they just, like, they have the head coach change, I think, is just, like, monstrous for them in a plus sense. And, like, they're probably going to try to make some trades, and their roster is not going to look anything like it did this season. So, like, I wouldn't count Philly out, but I think the East is just like a total toss-up is how I'm kind of exiting this conversation. So I would say that the Miami Heat certainly benefited from the bubble and the playoffs not having home court, because they would have had no home court in every single playoff series, which, you know, getting to play on a neutral site helped them more than anybody else, right? So that is certainly a factor. Whether or not they'll be able to re-sign Goran is huge. He was their leading scorer heading into the finals. That's not a small deal. And everything else that we just discussed with regards to, you know, free agency and all these different variables. But I would say they're in the mix. Is that like a cop? Am I copping out with that answer? Is that an okay?
Oh, 100% copping out, but it's fine. I agree. We're 100% sure they're not the overwhelming favorite to come back. They're going to be a factor. You know, Jimmy is not going to fall off a cliff magically. Like, he will be, certainly somebody to reckon with. Bam's going to have a career year next year. Tyler Hero is going to take a big step forward next year. They're going to be really good. I just wonder if just so many things broke right for them here in this spot, and the conditions were so favorable that it could be a situation where maybe they go out in the second round. They could actually be a better team next year and go out in the second round. That's just sometimes how it shakes out. Yep. If you don't have that, like, you know, top three player talent to kind of carry you through. A couple quick hitting things here at the end. My newsletter for the Washington Post this week was my 10 most memorable quotes of the bubble. I tried to have a wide variety, whether it was, you know, advocacy or activism and basketball and the goofy off-court stuff with pickleball and all that. And of course, you know, the Sterling Brown and George Hill factored, you know, majorly into this exercise, you know, with the Milwaukee Bucks shutdown. I'm curious, did you have a favorite quote or an encapsulating quote of the bubble experience, whether it was one of the interviews that you conducted with a lot of people along the way, maybe a Bill Walton zinger, or anything else that you feel like is the your favorite quote from this entire experience?
I mean, I didn't even actually think about the Bill Walton interview, but that whole thing is filled with magical quotes that everyone should go check out at GQ. Maybe it's recency bias, but honestly, Ben, I think my favorite quote, and I actually put it into my Twitter profile last night, is LeBron saying, "I want my damn respect too." I love, like, it really, previously I had "be better tomorrow," because that was my previous favorite LeBron quote.
So why did this one strike you so much?
Well, first of all, it's like, I fundamentally disagree with it because I just think, you know, giving attention to people who do not respect LeBron based on everything he had accomplished heading into the bubble really don't deserve your attention, right? Like, those people are absolute clowns who like, your opinion is just invalid in from where I'm sitting if you don't think that LeBron deserves respect after this entire career of just magnificent basketball and like civil rights advocacy. But for him to say it like he's not, at the same time, like, he is like, I don't know, like, he's just so self-confident in, like, I want my damn respect to, like, to, after the way he said it, after saying that, like, you know, Rob Pelinka deserves his respect, because there is certainly an argument to not give Rob Pelinka respect for this. To say that Frank Vogel deserves respect when I think you and I know that Frank Vogel, like, you and I respect Frank Vogel for sure, but heading into this season, Frank Vogel was not the first choice to be the head coach, and, you know, he's coming off a run with the Orlando Magic that wasn't great. And a lot of people were doubting him, in a sense, with some validity. So to give him respect is just like the way he said it, the context he said it in. I thought it was amazing. And I just, I don't know. Like, when LeBron speaks, sometimes he just says it's. It felt like it was off the cuff to me as well, which I really appreciated. And, like, give the man his respect. He's the best.
For sure. And look, I, you know, in hindsight, all those guys, their reputation takes a big step forward. Rob Pelinka stepping into a tricky spot, being willing to collaborate with Rich Paul, LeBron, and Anthony Davis to kind of make that trade happen. He was going to take all the blame if it backfired, right? No one's going to blame Rich Paul or the other guys who are kind of operating in the shadows. You know, if all those draft picks wind up blown up in your face and this is like the next Brooklyn Nets, you know, Boston Celtics trade type situation, that's Rob's reputation in that spot. Frank Vogel, like you mentioned, not their number one choice, came in humble but also ready to connect with his superstar players, not going to be a pushover, standing up, not having the arrogance of a David Blatt, finding a quick connection, finding an identity of physicality and defense that they were able to maintain all season long, and then carrying his team through all sorts of just absolutely ridiculous emotions and ultimately being himself. I mean, his post-game on-court interview where he was like shouting was pretty dorky. Gotta say, Frank Vogel, pretty dorky. It was a lot like, remember when he went on David Letterman when he was a kid? Wasn't he juggling as a kid on David Letterman? It was like that same kid growing up. Here he is on the greatest moment of his stage. I loved it too. I think that matters. You know, don't put on airs. Don't try to be someone you're not. You've never won a title yourself as a coach. So be humble about it and get through to the finish line. You're going to savor it that much more. And, you know, right on down the list, Rondo deserves a lot of credit. Dwight Howard, you know, not complaining about
whatever
anything along the way. You know, there's just a lot of a lot of people whose reputations look different once they get the title. That's why guys like Jared Dudley and Markieff Morris are running around screaming, "You've got to call me champ." You know, it's a reputation changer for sure. All right, let's close up here the last couple of minutes, Michael. I've mentioned this a couple times already, but I wrote a long essay for the Washington Post that ran on Sunday. I'm going to be tweeting it out today. That's basically goodbye to the bubble. And I tried to capture as much as I could about this experience, what was challenging, you know, what was fun, what were the standout moments, why was the Milwaukee Bucks protest bigger than literally everything else that happened here from kind of a news and attention standpoint. Tried to get into some of the nitty-gritty about daily life. I forwarded it to you and demanded that you read it. Hopefully you have accomplished that goal, Michael. Any questions or takeaways from that piece, hit me.
No, it was a great piece. A really comprehensive wrap-up of what it was like to be in the bubble for so long. And I think, like, I'm kind of just starting off with, like, I mean, I knew a lot of the stuff that you said because you and I converse multiple times a week and we text and all that. But one of the things I didn't know was this line that you wrote. Quote, I now own the same polo shirt in 7 different colors. I don't even like polo shirts. So my question, Ben, is why didn't you ask me for some fashion advice when you were doing your online shopping?
Oh, because you're the GQ guy. That's right. well, look, I mentioned that part. First of all, that seems to be everybody's favorite line, which is kind of hilarious because it was such a toss away and I thought the editors were going to cut it, but they didn't. Look, exhausting late nights. Everybody's probably been there. You get to the online shopping and you make bad decisions at 3 a.m. You know, there's probably some apps that could, you know, probably like limit, you know, which, you know, how much I'm able to use my phone at certain hours where you might be more prone to do some impulse buying versus others. Part of my defense in terms of buying so many polo shirts is that I didn't really calculate how hot and humid it was going to be properly down here. And I also, I'm not sure I completely believed I was going to be down here for 3 months when I first came. So I didn't do a terrible job packing, but I didn't do a great job packing. And I needed some reinforcements. Did I need 7 of the same polo shirts in different colors so I could go a full week rotation with different shades of polo shirts? The answer is no. But ultimately, like, I didn't feel I needed to really invest in true fashion advice because this wasn't Rodeo Drive, you know. This was Coronado Springs Resort, you know. And as I felt a little uncomfortable wearing t-shirts to the game. Some people did that. I didn't want to wear a dress shirt every single day because that just turns into a hassle of, you know, washing them and ironing them and all that stuff. So polo shirts was kind of my my middle ground. But I now have an awful lot of polo shirts I'm not totally sure I'm ever going to wear again. But yeah, thanks for highlighting the important part.
Yeah, that was the most important thing. But actually, I have an actual serious question. Where are you donating the polo shirts? No, that was not my serious question. My actual serious question is, now that you are leaving the bubble, you know, the bubble was the safest place in the United States of America for the past 3 months. You're going back into the wilderness where we're now kind of maybe experiencing a second wave as a nation of coronavirus. I know that just from talking to you before the bubble, you know, you were extremely cautious and, you know, very rarely leaving your apartment and taking all sorts of precautions. So, like, how have you mentally prepared for just the utter weirdness of going from the daily testing and wearing the ring and all of that to the outside world where it's basically anything goes now and people are kind of just wearing masks when they want to?
So I was starting to wonder about you with that polo shirt question, but now you've asked the money question. So very good work, Michael. This is the whole crux of the piece, or a major crux of it. You know, I've been thinking, okay, I get to take off this tracking ring, right? I don't have to wear this credential, which is like an ID. I don't have to wear my tracking band, which monitors my movement. I don't have to wear my proximity alarm, which beeps every time I'm within 6 people. And there's this idea of, like, as soon as this car comes to pick me up in 2 hours, I'm going to be able to, like, strip all this stuff off and I'm going to be free. But in reality, none of us are free, right? We're all haunted by these germs that can even touch the President of the United States. If you take this thing seriously, it's still as big, if not a bigger challenge now mentally and, you know, in terms of structuring your life than it was when I first got down here. I certainly thought when I left in July I was going to be coming back to a better, more functional world after 3 months in this bubble and that we were going to maybe have turned a corner. I don't see any corner being turned. We have maybe counted down a little bit closer to when there would be a vaccine. So that's progress. Just the passage of time helps. This thing isn't going to go on forever, but we have not made the significant improvement as a society here in the United States to make me feel very comfortable at all. So the blessing in disguise for me is that I'm going to be writing a book for the next 3 months, and that's going to require a lot of alone time inside, solitary, you know, low-risk behavior. Writing a book is probably one of the lowest-risk things you can do during a pandemic other than podcasting. So I think from that standpoint, I'm going to be, you know, basically safe from now through January. But I mean, all the stuff that I did coming here in July, I'm going to do again going home. I've got a private car picking me up here pretty shortly. I've got a mask. I've got the face shield. I'm going to wear rubber gloves. I'm going through an airport where, you know, there's been all sorts of issues here in Florida. I'm flying first class, which I don't normally do, just so that I have more space and social distance.
Look at you.
Well, the same thing I did coming down here, because I just am not, I maybe freaked out, some people would say, but you just can't be too cautious, you know? Now, a lot of people are dying here, and I want my risk to be as close to zero. I'm not trying to take any chances, and, you know, it's just too far to drive. Like, that's the other part, too, is that if it was a one-day drive, I would drive rather than fly, but there's just no way to make that happen. So, you know, once I get home, I think the big question for me is how am I going to reacclimate to not having the testing? Because the testing provides an immense peace of mind. Every single day, you get an email here that says you're negative every day. And you go in the next day, it's a little bit of a hassle, it's a little bit of annoyance, but you get that email and you know for a fact that you're in a good spot. And, you know, if you live outside for a week or 2 weeks after having that level of care and attention and everything else, I do wonder mentally, am I going to miss it? Am I going to be wondering? Am I going to want to go in and get tested just to make sure? Like, I just don't know how I'm going to react to that. So that part, it's, you know, it's a little bit of apprehension. But I also think that I'm going to be living as safe as I can. And I encourage everybody who listens to this to stick to the script. We're not done with this thing. It's still killing people. If you don't remain vigilant, you're just as at risk now as you were back in March. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just, you know, stick to the script. Like I said, I'm preaching that same message to everybody that I care about. Even Michael, when you're going on like short vacations with your wife, you know, I'm getting nervous on your behalf, and I'm glad, you know, everything's been safe and you've been able to do that. But, you know, that kind of goes for everyone. You know, even seeing those pictures of Lakers fans celebrating in LA, you know, made me a little bit sick to my stomach. I understand their need for a release. I completely get it, but man, it, you know, it's hard to
watch
that.
That was tough. Yeah.
So that's where I'm at on that one. And, you know, we're going to check in. Like you mentioned, you know, we talk twice a week. So you're going to be experiencing my reacclimation to society with me. I mean, there are a few things I'm looking forward to. I haven't driven a car since July. And I like to drive my car on LA's freeways, especially when there's no other traffic there. And that's like one thing about
never.
Well, it's funny because one thing about being a sports writer, like when you're done with the games at, you know, midnight or one,
yeah,
you know, you can fly down the freeway and have a pretty good time. So I'll miss doing that. I miss the ocean breeze a lot. You know, the lakes and ponds here on campus were pretty nice. I saw all sorts of cool animals and stuff, but not the same as the Pacific. I miss ethnic food. You know, I've been eating a lot of potatoes for the last 3 months. I would love to get some Thai food, some Chinese food, literally mm-hmm. anything besides bland American salty food and Caesar salads. I'm looking forward to that. So yeah, you know, and like I said, the listeners will be with us as we go here the next couple weeks, and I may be leaning on you for advice about, yeah, what is the real world like? Because I'm sure there's going to be a culture shock just like there was when I first got down here.
Yeah. It'll be different for sure, but I think I just want to wrap up by saying that I speak on behalf of everyone who listens to this show when I say thank you for your coverage, which was tremendous throughout the entire thing. I don't know even how you found some of the stories that you did. The pickleball one was tremendous, and yeah, you're one of the best to do it. I'm honored to be your co-host on this show. I'm shocked that you never even canceled one time, because if I was in the bubble, I would have been canceling regularly on you, probably, because I couldn't handle the anxiety and the stress. So yeah, you're a workhorse, and congratulations, my guy.
Well, one of my very favorite phrases, and longtime listeners will know, is the greatest ability is availability. And you probably heard LeBron on court. He almost said it last night. I think he said the best thing you can do for your teammates is to be available. That, you know, nearly brought a tear to my eye. I thank all the Open Floor Globe members who sent, you know, that quote to me and said, oh, he's pretty much saying what you say. I think it's true. It's a mantra. It's a lifestyle. That's what I've tried to stick to here. And I do think that when you get into routines, especially during stressful situations, That can be the biggest help of all. And certainly there's a lot of therapeutic value to doing these podcasts, to talking to someone on the outside world, even if he's an unhinged Boston Celtics fan lunatic like Michael Pina. There's a lot of value to that. It just, you know, keeps order, it keeps balance, and you know, it kind of makes you realize, like, hey, you know, one show at a time, you know, you're going to be able to get through it. And then you look up and boom, 93 days later, you actually get to be freed from Disney World. By the way, Michael, not sure I'm ever coming back to Disney World. No disrespect to the Walt Disney Company. I think I've had my fill. All right. On that note, Michael, we're going to double back later this week. I will be back in society. We will take all the listeners' off-season questions. If there was anything else from today's episode that we overlooked, you know, in terms of wrapping up the finals, the Lakers side, the Heat side, anything else that you guys are curious about, email us. openfloormail@gmail.com, openfloormail@gmail.com. And let me just say this, listeners. I just, like Michael said thank you to me, I appreciate him, and I should say thank you back to him. He's been an unbelievable co-pilot on this journey, ultra reliable, ultra informative, awesome, hilarious takes, you know, stirring the pot, getting you guys engaged. I loved every bit of it here in the bubble. We are headed forward into the offseason, and it could be a longer offseason than usual. We just don't know yet. Now is the time for you guys to step up and email us all your questions. We will take them, hypotheticals, whatever it might be, you know, free agency ideas, draft ideas. We want them right now. Email them, openfloormail@gmail.com, openfloormail@gmail.com. We're also on Apple Podcasts. If you search for Open Floor, that's two words. When you find our page, scroll down. It will say rate and review. Tap 5 stars. It's just that easy to help us spread the word. Now, Michael is on Instagram and Twitter at Michael V as in Victor Pina. I'm on Instagram at Ben.Golliver, on Twitter at Ben Golliver. Check out that Washington Post newsletter that I mentioned. And you know what else, Michael? They should pre-order the book. Go to Amazon and go ahead and add that to your cart. Buy it now. It's called Bubble Ball, and I would greatly appreciate it. All right, Michael. Until later this week, I will talk to you.
Talk soon, Ben.